Members, we're going to get started. It's the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Today is Tuesday, February 10th, and we do not yet have a quorum. Representative Bingham, we are going to ask that you start with House File 129. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bingham, this bill needs to be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety policy omnibus bill. Yes. Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is one technical amendment that Mr. Diebel noticed that if we could move orally on it.
Representative Bingham, do you want to let us know what that is?
Mr. Diebel, if you wanted to... Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair and members, page 1, line 10, before radio, insert or.
And I would move that.
Questions from members? All right. We officially have a quorum, so I officially call this meeting to order. All right, Representative Bingham moves the oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Bingham.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, House File 29 is further closing a loophole on a wonderful bill that the Chair did 2 years ago regarding prohibiting solicitation of minors over the computer. And for clarity purposes, we are going to add cell phones as a result of some instances that have occurred because of text messaging and picture messaging. We just want to clarify that the intent of the law also is to include cell phones. So you would no longer be able to, in addition to computers, you would no longer be able to solicit minors over the with text messaging or picture messaging with the cell phone. And I have Mr. Voigt here from the Attorney General's Office. Are there any questions?
Questions from members? Representative Kamar.
I have a question on the amendment. I'm not sure what you just did there with the, what's the difference between electronic communication system and a communication system?
Mr. Debo.
Madam Chair and members, the intent of the amendment is to clarify on starting on line 9 to line 10 that after the or on line 9, it says, or a telecommunications, wire, or radio communication systems. Telecommunications, wire, and radio all modify communication system, and it wasn't clear from the way it was drafted that the communication system should be tied to, radio communication system is modified by telecommunications, wire, or radio communication. And that's why the or brings the three phrases clarifies that three phrases all modify system.
Yes.
Why do you have the language on line 9 then?
Mr. Debo?
It just seems like it's a redundancy here.
Madam Chair and members, the intent is to be inclusive to perhaps the fault of being over-inclusive. But I think that was the problem with the original bill, was that law enforcement and prosecutors felt like there were some loopholes. So perhaps we double-knotted things, but we made sure that we have everything that could possibly fall in the law and put it in here.
Representative Tamar, it is the belt and suspenders version of the bill. So just want to make sure we have clear intent on what we're asking prosecutors and judges to interpret.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Bingham, we will lay over House File 129 for possible inclusion in the public safety policy omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Bingham. Representative Less still in the room?
Yeah.
Representative Less, can we do your report from your division?
I think we can have here. So for my report, Madam Chair?
Representative Less.
Thank you.
For my report, I'm presuming I'm just moving House File 139 and House File 254. And
Representative West, what I need you to do is move adoption of the division report, and then we'll have to move each one of those bills to their proper place.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative West. Representative West, please briefly describe what you did and what happened.
Well, Madam Chair, very briefly, House File 139 is pretty straightforward, designating October as Domestic Violence Awareness Month in Minnesota. As was stated, it was very non-controversial. I think Representative Coles was challenged to come up with a question on this, which he did, but I don't think it was a very good question. I don't know where he went now. It does share, October is shared with Breast Cancer Awareness Month, for the month of October. So, nonetheless, the bill passed here. On House File 254, Crime Alert Notification, Representative Thiessen, and is he, I won't ask that next question, Madam Chair. Essentially, Madam Chair, it related to the disclosure of crime reports. Representative Thiessen had a blind constituent who was looking to have access to certain crime reports from the Richfield Police in light of the fact that his designated screen reader software could not receive PDF files. And so we submitted this as an amendment to ensure that the crime reports were generally readily readable by his screen software, and that they would be generally available to individuals with disabilities like his constituent.
Thank you, Representative West. Is there further questions from the members regarding the adoption of the division report? Representative Hamer?
Are we going to have discussion on the bills too, or is this just on the adopting the report?
Representative Hamer, yes, we'll be adopting the division report, and then we actually have to ask for some brief public testimony, nothing new on each of the bills, and then we have to send them on their separate way. So questions on the adoption of the division report? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Next, we have House File 139, which is Representative Doty's bill, and that members, Representative Doty is here if there are questions from members. I don't want to redo the hearing of Representative Lesh, so when I ask for public testimony for or against, they will be asking for anything that was not discussed in Representative Lesh's committee. So, Representative Doty, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I will make this very brief because the bill itself is very brief and easy to understand. We are in uncertain economic times. We know there's a correlation between domestic violence and financial difficulties. We are not expecting this problem to go away on its own. We are also, because of these desperate times, not in possession of large piles of money to deal with the problem. And so it seems like something that is this obvious that can help awareness and prevent domestic violence would be a very sensible direction for us to go at this time. The bill simply would establish October as Domestic Violence Awareness Month. I have with me Cindy Cook, representing the Coalition for Battered Women. If you were watching statewide media last night, you saw her as she gave the 2008 femicide report some very human dimensions. So if there are questions, direct them either to me or to Ms. Cook.
Questions from members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Doty and I can't remember the Ms. Cook.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. How exactly will this bill help reduce domestic violence?
Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, I would look at it this way. The more public awareness that we can create around this issue, the more opportunities that we have to educate people, to talk to young people about healthy relationships, to talk to all the intervening systems to intervene more effectively, we can have a greater impact on both preventing domestic violence before it starts and intervening more effectively once it happens.
And Representative Doty.
And Madam Chair and Representative, one of the things that happens when you have an officially designated month is it seems to be easier to work it into school curriculums, for example, put the posters up and just simply gives you an excuse to get a lot more publicity. So we're sure that this will increase that.
Representative Drakowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any additional cost to the state budget from this or from school budgets?
Representative Doty.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think if there's any additional cost, it would be very minimal. We do have in my own district, we have schools that have already incorporated domestic violence awareness into their curriculum. They do that as usually part of a health curriculum. It has, we not had enough time so that we see percentages down the road or any hard evidence like that. But the people that are involved in it are very much more aware, and we think that without any allocated expenses, let's put it that way, that we can raise awareness. There should be no definite budget increases or anything like that from this. Will somebody spend more money because of it? That'll be up to them.
All right. Seeing no further questions, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Understand that we have already heard this issue in Representative Lesh's committee, and this is for anything that's new. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and be mindful that this has been heard in another committee. That is a division of this committee.
Yes, Tim Kinley, improprior persona and sumo juris, meaning I'm coming here as my proper person. I'm not a government entity, an artificial corporation. I'm me. And of the highest order of law. I apologize if I do repeat something, but I'm for the bill. I'm against domestic violence, but it's committed against women, children, and men. And right now the marketing is women and children. So what I would like to see a change in the way it's worded, that it would be, say, men, women, and children, or children, women, and men, or whatever. I don't care the order. It's the public awareness is that men don't get abused yet, and that women don't abuse. And statistically, by the Bureau of Criminal Statistics in Minnesota, women are the number one abusers of children. Okay? Men also abuse children. Neither should be abusing children. And so I would like to see, if this is a public awareness campaign, that men get included in this, that men shouldn't be abused. And there's been over 150, it's in the 180s, I don't know the exact number, studies on domestic violence. It's been compiled by Martin Siebert. You can look it up on the internet. And it's done a lot of empirical studies, majority of empirical studies done by doctorate educated women, to say that men in their studies get abused just as much, just as violently as women do. Okay, so I just think, as far as the awareness goes, let's open it up, let's have the truth out there, and then we can deal with the problem. Because as long as we just focus, it's only happening to women and children, then the problem will never be addressed. So those are my concerns.
Thank you. Questions from members? All right, seeing none. Representative Lesh renews his motion that House File 139 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to State and Local Government Operations Reform, Technology, and Elections Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Thiessen. Representative Lesh will move that House File 254 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Justice Committee. Representative Thiessen. Representative Cornish, yes.
Madam Chair, just one thing that kind of confused me when you said something about Representative Lesh's committee, the bill's coming here just for something new. Those people that aren't on Representative Lesh's committee, it's kind of new, and we still hear the bill again here, wouldn't we?
Representative Cornish, what we're attempting to do, because Representative Lesh's committee is a division of this committee, we do want people, and that's why the authors are here, to kind of briefly tell us about the bill and allow members to ask questions, but we don't want to repeat the hearings, because if he's meeting every week or every other week for an hour and a half to kind of flesh out the issues that are within the jurisdiction of his committee, I don't feel like we need to repeat that work, but we want members to have the opportunity to question the authors if they need to, and allow members If there is the public that wants to testify on an issue that wasn't addressed in Representative West's committee, to allow them to come forward and talk about their concerns.
But our members would still get a chance to question the bill then, so?
That is correct. Okay. That's why we continue to ask if members have any questions.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Cornish. Representative Thiessen, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This legislation came to me from a constituent who is blind and has been interested for several years, in fact, in getting updates about getting crime alerts, basically, that the city of Richfield, in this case, puts out. But because of the form in which the city of Richfield circulates those electronically, the technology he has in his computer to read the documents, he's not able to kind of access that information. And so he testified in Representative West's committee. There's others who he has heard from who are in similar situations in jurisdictions other than Richfield who have encountered the same issue. So really what this bill does is say if a city or other local jurisdiction is going to provide a crime alert to folks in its jurisdiction, to its citizens, that should be in a form that is accessible to blind people. And really what that means is that it has to be in Word format. That's the bottom line. The city of Richfield, for instance, issued it in a PDF which can't be read. All they would have had to do, all they would need to do is also circulate it either in text form in the email itself or as an attached Word document, and they would comply with this. I honestly think federal law probably requires them to do it anyway. Because it's not just a Richfield issue, according to my constituents, but there's people in other jurisdictions, that's what we're attempting to provide here, basic kind of equal access to crime information.
Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Thiessen, you say this went through Representative Lesher's committee?
Yes.
Was there any mention of the cost to the police department for this at that time, or are we going to hold off and discuss that in finance?
Representative Thiessen.
I don't think it'll go to finance because it would be a local cost. So it's not a state budget cost. There was not much discussion except for the fact that what it would require is actually typing up it as a Word document, which I can't imagine is going to put too big a burden on law enforcement agencies. And in fact, it's also important, I think, that it's not requiring anything to happen. If they don't provide these alerts, they don't incur any cost. But it's actually a very simple, inexpensive solution. It's just not happening.
Madam Chair?
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, was there any testimony from the police department at the...
No, there was no testimony.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you.
I think they had representatives in the room, but they didn't testify. So, thank you.
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, thank you. My question was the same as Representative Anderson. Great.
Representative Paymar.
Well, Madam Chair, I had a similar concern about it, but I just I'm not going to request the bill. But this is you are mandating law enforcement agencies throughout the state to do this, and we've had discussion about what doesn't seem like a major impact to local jurisdictions, and I'm not saying this does or doesn't, but these are the kinds of things that get us in trouble sometimes.
And again, Madam Chair, I think that they got to do this under federal law anyway, and they're not doing it. I honestly think, and I'd be happy if any of the police folks want to come down and testify. That would be, I'd love to hear the answer. But I think turning it into a Word document, it's just not a very difficult thing to do.
So, Representative Cass.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What got brought up in committee and something that I think is of positive light here is the fact that when he did talk to his local police department, they were able to put it in a Word document and had already been doing that. And that's the problem I have, is that a lot of the new documents or the text-based screen reader software already reads PDFs. And so the concern that I have is that, the first step is to ask your police department to do that, and the gentleman that testified did ask his police department, and they did comply with this. And so, you know, that's my concern, is that initial first step adequate, or do we have to codify this?
Representative Lesch.
I'll pass.
Representative Houston. Any comments?
No.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lesch renews his motion that House File 254 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Justice Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Houston. Representative Bingham. Representative Bingham moves that House File 130 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Justice Committee. Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have another oral problem on this particular bill, so I would move a quick oral amendment on line 5.1 after the word after the comma, after the word access, insert or.
Do members have that? Question from members. Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, am I reading something wrong? It looks like persons required to register under this section shall not access, create, or maintain, and you want to add another or to the existing? Isn't that what proper English is? Well, we can.
Mr. Beadle,
I think you may want to rethink that eventually.
Mr. Beadle, do you have a suggestion?
Madam Chair, members, I'd defer to Mr. Voigt because I haven't heard of this amendment.
Okay, Mr. Voigt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is David Voigt. I'm a Deputy Attorney General. I think the reason for the or, the additional or after the word access, is because access is in a different category than the other words that follow it. I believe the intent is to prohibit registered sex offenders from not only accessing certain sites like Facebook or MySpace, but also from creating or maintaining a personal web page. So without that first or before create, access gets thrown in with the others and may refer to simply accessing a personal web page rather than accessing the site in the first place.
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, then Mr. Voigt, shouldn't the comma after, if you're saying access is separate, then after create you should take out the comma.
Mr. Voigt.
I think that's correct.
Okay, members, Representative Bingham, are you offering an oral amendment to remove the comma?
Yes, Madam Chair, I am.
Questions from members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the bill's already kind of been explained. I had this bill last year, and it unfortunately didn't make it out of conference committee because it needed some work. And I will go into what we changed as a request, not a request, but as working with Representative Lesch on his concern. First, House File 30 prohibits registered sex offenders from accessing social networking websites. And that is Facebook and MySpace. And the other component that we added this year was chatting. Like, for example, if you're on an accessible network that would allow you to play cards with somebody via the internet, and there are chat rooms allowed in these gaming rooms, and we didn't want we wanted to prohibit that as well. And that was as a discussion and a point of concern from Representative Lesch last year. The logical question on this is, well, how are you going to enforce this? When you are a registered sex offender, you are subject to unannounced searches of your person, house, car. We are going to extend that to the computer and PDAs and such. And the other logical question is, well, is this going to cost anything? The answer is we are delaying this until August 1st of 2010 because every year a registered sex offender is sent a notification letter.
And the prosecutors have asked that we need to be able to prove that they were notified in order to charge this case. And I'm not a lawyer, just for the record. Took out the cost of the bill. So I can ask if Mr. Voigt has anything to add or...
Mr. Voigt? Madam Chair, the purpose of the bill is simply to keep sex offenders off, primarily the social networking website. I'd just like to add that we've seen news reports in the last week or two that there have been over 90,000 sex offenders removed from the MySpace site alone over the years. The social networking websites don't want sex offenders on their websites. Their problem is that there's nothing to prevent the sex offenders from going there in the first place, other than maybe their own user agreements, which can be disregarded. And their problem is they can't always identify registered sex offenders, and this is something that goes to that problem.
Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, is this bill going on to finance?
Representative Anderson, this has to go to civil justice next.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
But after that, Madam Chair, does it go on to finance?
Representative Paymar, do you want to enlighten us as to whether or not you'll be requesting this bill?
Madam Chair, I would like to hear from Representative Bigham about the impact. We won't have an impact this year, but there ostensibly will be a cost in the following year, and whether you have that.
Representative Bingham. Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing I'd like to say, I do appreciate working with the Attorney General's office on this bill. To Representative Chamber's question, the fiscal note I received last year had a $20,000 fiscal note on it for notification if this was implemented immediately. By delaying it the year, it took out that fiscal note. There was nothing in the fiscal note from that was requested that indicated any financial impact.
Representative Paymar.
I'm confused then. So if it's not $20,000 this year, it's $20,000 next year, so there is a fiscal impact, no?
Representative Bingham? Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, no, there is no cost to it because it's going to be included in their notification letter. Every year they are sent a letter that says, that lays out certain things you can't do, and this is going to be included in that letter and from here on out.
Very good, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this directed solely at sex offenders that are assigned level 3 status after release from prison?
Representative Bingham.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, is for any registered sex offender, so whether it's the 10-year or the lifetime.
Representative Johnson?
No further questions right now.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Bingham renews her motion that House File 130 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Civil Justice Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bingham.
Thank you.
Next, we have the minutes. Representative Cass, did you move the minutes? Representative Cass moves the minutes. Questions or comments from members? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Next, we have a presentation from the court. Whenever you're ready. Please go ahead and state your name for the record. And go ahead.
My name is Jeff Schwarba, and I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. I'm going to be joined today by Deb Daly, who is Manager of the Court's Research and Evaluation Unit. You've had a packet that's been presented to you, and there's a PowerPoint that we'll be following through. We've been asked today to provide some information on the organization and administrative structure of the branch, discuss the branch's strategic plan and goals, and provide an overview of the process used by the branch to measure performance. I'm going to begin with an overview of the branch, and then I will turn things over to Deb Daly to talk a little bit about performance measures. On slide two, we'll start with the mission of the judicial branch, which is to provide justice through a system that assures equal access for the fair and timely resolution of cases and controversies. This mission statement stems directly from the words of the Constitution, which you see on the next slide. Article 1 provides a remedy for all injuries or wrongs to persons, property, or character, freely and without purchase, completely and without denial, promptly and without delay. Thus, the Constitution, as you can see, commands that every case, not just criminal cases, be handled promptly and without delay. As you'll see when we get to some of our performance measures, you'll see that in some cases delays are increasing, which is jeopardizing meeting that particular part of the Constitution. So we begin talking a little bit about that core government function. The next slide gives you a little bit of an overview of the judicial branch. Right now we have 315 judges, 289 of those who serve at the trial court level, and almost 2,800 employees. We have 2 million cases that are filed in our courts every year, and we hear them in 100 locations around the state, geographically more than any other agency in state government. Our current annual budget is a little over $300 million. This helps fund the trial courts, the appellate courts, the state court administrator's office, and the state law library. Our budget, this $300 million, does not include civil legal services or the public defender system. Both of those are funded with separate appropriations, and both are administered by separate boards and are not part of the judicial branch, just to clarify those two entities. The next slide provides an overview of the organizational structure of the courts. We have a streamlined three-tier structure of two appellate courts and a single trial court. Supreme Court with 7 justices, here's cases en banc, and here's appeals from the Court of Appeals, and also from the Tax Court and the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, which are both part of the executive branch and funded out of the executive branch. The court has original jurisdiction for first-degree murder conviction appeals, legislative election contests, and judicial and attorney discipline. Court of Appeals has 19 judges, and hears cases in 3-judge panels throughout the state. We hear appeals from the trial courts, of course, as well as the Commission of Economic Security and some administrative agency decisions. The district court hears all other cases, civil, criminal, probate, mental health, juvenile, and has nearly all of the 2 million cases that are filed every year in the state of Minnesota. The next slide gives you an overview of how the trial courts are organized into 10 judicial districts. Counties with large populations, as you see, Hennepin and Ramsey, the 4th and 2nd districts, are one district. In less populated areas, there are several counties in a district, the largest being in the northwest corner of the state, where the 9th judicial district has 17 counties. These 10 districts not only serve as administrative districts, but also as election districts for trial court judges sitting for election. In the last over 3 decades, there have been a number of administrative reforms in the judicial branch. 1972, with a constitutional amendment, we changed from having court administrators be elected clerks in each county to appointed. They are now appointed and serve at the pleasure of the district court bench. In 1974, we organized Justice of the Peace Courts throughout the state, were sunsetted, and were transferred into the county court system that was established at that time. In 1978, with the Court Reorganization Act, we began developing the 10 judicial districts, creating a district administrator for each district for administrative purposes, and also a chief judge for the district to serve with the district administrator on management of the district. In 1982, by constitutional amendment, the Court of Appeals was created. Then we had a 5-year period for unification of the trial courts, both county-based courts as well as district judges, united together into one district court bench to hear all cases at the trial court level. and that took a 5-year period and required the vote of every county court bench as well as district court bench before unification was accomplished. The largest and most recent change being the 15-year period of state funding transition. This 15-year-long transition from county to state funding of the trial courts changed more than just who writes our checks. It's more akin to a merger of large organizations, going from 87 different entities to a single unified system under a single umbrella of funding now, as well as aligning our governance structure, which is how we came up in 2005 at the completion of state funding with the new Judicial Council, and I'll talk about that in 1 minute.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just one question.
Mm-hmm.
You said the county court system was started in 1974. Why did we have county court judges before that then?
We had, what I was trying to say in 1974, we had county court judges, but we also had justices of the peace and other judges. They were all unified into the county court in 1974. And some said it was justices of the peace.
Please continue.
Thanks. Slide number 8 looks a little bit at the administrative structure of the courts. It's headed by the Chief Justice, who's responsible for the overall management of the courts, as well as chairing the Judicial Council. The state court administrator and her employees serve as staff to the Judicial Council. They also provide central administrative infrastructure services to the entire judicial branch in the areas of human resources, finances, legal research, information technology, research and evaluation, etc. The Chief Justice, of course, also leads the Supreme Court, which continues to have responsibility for regulating the practice of law, including promulgating statewide rules of procedure and practice before all courts of the state. There's a Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals appointed by the Governor to a 3-year term who serves as the head of the Court of Appeals. And there's a Chief Judge in each of the districts elected by their respective benches who's responsible for the management of the entire district. Chief Judge, as I mentioned before, is assisted by a Judicial District Administrator, and there are County Court Administrators who oversee the day-to-day operations in each county. The Judicial Council serves as the single statewide policymaking body for the branch. It's responsible for making administrative policy in a number of areas, strategic planning, etc., as well as importantly serving as the outreach and liaison with the bar, justice agencies, the community, criminal justice agencies. It's made up of 25 members, as I mentioned, chaired by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. It's important to note that the Judicial Council sets these policies, but it's the responsibility of the individual courts throughout the state to implement them at the court level. One of the major duties of the Judicial Council is the development of a broad strategic plan. In your packets on the left-hand side, you have a copy of our current branch strategic plan. Our current plan was for a 3-year period from fiscal years 2007 to 2009. It was developed after a lengthy input process from various groups to identify strategic issues and develop strategies to improve overall court performance. There are currently 3 broad categories within the strategic plan: access to justice, administering justice for effective results, and public trust, accountability, and impartiality. For each of these, there are initiatives aimed at implementing each priority. All court activities are aligned with the strategic plan. It's not a document for the court system that sits on a shelf after creation. It dictates our budget priorities, it helps focus our legislative requests for our budget, and determines workload and staffing in each of these areas. The Judicial Council is responsible for approving the plan. There's an annual progress report that's given to the Council. And currently we are working on the FY 10 and 11 strategic plan that will be finalized following the legislative session. I don't really have time to go through, and maybe you don't want me to go through each particular part of the plan, so I thought I would just pick out the first strategic goal, which is on page 7 of the plan, that talks about access to justice. There are 3 main implementation priorities under there: completing our transition to Memphis, which we just completed with the last county coming online in April of 2008, and fostering better, consistent practices of implementing data into that system, as well as sending over 35,000 messages a day out to our criminal justice partners that come from the court system information that's inputted into Memphis. Our second is instituting electronic case initiation. We began that with pilots for both criminal e-filing around the state in counties such as Hennepin, Ramsey, St. Louis, Carver, Olmsted. where complaints can be filed electronically from county attorney's offices into the court system without requiring inputting of daily information, as well as transferring information directly from law enforcement, police officers, and other law enforcement entities into the court system. And again, we have pilots throughout the state, Ramsey, Hennepin, St. Louis, Anoka, and are now working on the state patrol to try to make that a reality with them. The last one under the access to justice is expanding resources for pro se litigants. We've used the resources that we have in terms of attorneys in the pro se self-help center in Hennepin to expand that resource across the state. So now when you walk into any courthouse across the state, you'll find a computer terminal with online access to forms and information staffed and updated by staff in the Hennepin self-help center, as well as a telephone where you can actually pick up a telephone line and talk to an individual, an attorney in the Hennepin Self-Help Center who can help you with your case, help you decide where to turn for resources. As we see the number of pro se litigants growing, it's very important that we have that kind of resources statewide, not just in the metro counties.
Can I ask, didn't you just reduce the number of hours that the pro se litigation center is open, Mr. Sorba?
Madam Chair, there were some reductions in terms of counters in Hennepin and Ramsey, as well as some other districts. I think there's still online access to the self-help center from Hennepin, though. I'm not quite sure if that was reduced as the same amount of hours as the counters in Hennepin. But.
All right. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sharba,
mm-hmm.
Do you, the Judicial Council, meet here in the Twin Cities, or do they meet throughout the state periodically?
Mr. Sorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we meet here in the Judicial Center on a regular basis once a month, but twice a year we go out for outreach to the outer parts of the state. Usually one time we meet with the Bar Association in conjunction with their annual meeting, and then we pick another location throughout the state to try to meet outstate in other areas than the Twin Cities. Usually we try to spend part of that time hearing from court employees as well as criminal justice individuals in those communities about things that they may be concerned about, new efforts, initiatives, etc. So twice a year the council meets outside of St. Paul.
Please continue.
Just to mention about some of the efficiency strategies that stem from our transition to state funding. As a result of state funding and our ability now to move resources across county lines and standardize processes, we've been able to gain efficiencies across the state. We've used our staffing study, which projects staff need based on case growth, to better match resources to places where there are staffing demands. One of the ways we've had to do this is by equalizing funding allocations across the state. We've had to look at individual places that have come in with different levels of county funding and try to allocate funding on a more equal level across the state. Unfortunately, in these times of dire economic situations, we are not able to fully fund any location, even though we have equally tried to equalize funding across the state. So unfortunately now, all places are underfunded, but not at 100% of their staffing level need. We've also, in terms of flattening our management structure, when we came into state funding, there were court administrators in each county. We've now reduced that by 40%. So those county administrators in those counties now oversee more than one county. In fact, we now have one jurisdiction that is moving to have, that already has three counties reporting to one court administrator, and we're on the verge shortly of having one county administrator oversee four counties. So we begin to flatten that structure as well as our district structure, with one of our district administrators overseeing two counties, as well as supervisory and management cuts, both at the district level and state court administrator level. We've also used state court funding to flexibly move work where we have demands in situations where we may have a high workload, but maybe not the people to do it. Our MINSA system now allows us to do work electronically, so we can move that work across county lines within a district to help meet that workload demand across the state. We've also been able to gain efficiencies on a program level in areas such as guardian ad litem, jury, psych services, and our collections process. Now that programs are funded and overseen by one entity, we can standardize practices to save money and at the same time provide better service. One example is in the guardian ad litem area. Prior to state funding in 2001, there were 56 different programs with 56 different managers across the state, no comprehensive training statewide or monitoring, and as a result, 40% of the abused and neglected children had no representation. Once we took this over, we've now provided coverage to 100% of the children, reduced the management staffing by over a third, provide standardized and mandatory training for employees and contractors, and increased and provided a quality review process as well as a complaint and investigative process. We've similarly done the same type of thing in the statewide coordinated debt collection. Again, different counties at the time we took over state funding doing things differently. We now have a standardized referral process, are using an outside vendor. Since beginning that program 3 years ago, we've referred over $125 million of debt and collected $20 million that goes to the state general fund, state agencies, and local units of government by standardizing this process and doing some type of a private referral. On the performance level, and I'll let Deb talk a little bit more of this, about this, but I want to talk a little bit about performance as noted by others. Obviously, there are things we're doing ourselves to recognize our performance, but there are also outside entities who look at us. We are audited on a continual basis by the Office of Legislative Auditor. In one report, they said that Minnesota judges carry caseloads that average 49% higher than comparable states. A recent comparison of Hennepin County judges with similar metropolitan counties across the country showed that judges in Hennepin carry caseloads twice as high as similar metropolitan counties across the state. We've also done our own review.
Representative West.
Thanks. My question is on the performance piece with the 49% higher caseload. Do our judges say that 6 weeks vacation?
Our judges.
Sure,
I Representative West and Chair, Representative Chair. I believe it is 6 weeks. It's the standard that's provided to state employees. It's sort of on the same type of basis, but I believe it is that amount. I'm not absolutely positive.
Okay, and Madam Chair, Mr. Schorber, also, what is the other amount of, say, off time that judges get for professional development or what have you? I thought that it was an additional 4 weeks, but it may not be. Can you tell me what that is?
I think it's Representative Lush, Madam Chair. I believe it is a number of days. I don't believe it's a number of weeks. I don't know exactly the number of days. I thought it was actually 4 days a year, but I can check for that and let the committee know.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, I would be curious because I know for a fact that the judges I deal with, and I see Representative Paymar smiling over there because he knows it's a point of contention. Every time I turn around, I want to try a case. It seems someone's got some conference at Cragen's or what have you. Huh?
Madden's,
yeah, wherever they go. I've never been there, I can tell you that. But if you could find that out, it would be interesting.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Turning to the next slide, if I can work this out.
The last thing I want to point out before turning over to Deb are rankings by outside entities. The courts have been shown a lot of trust by the business community and the public. A National Chamber of Commerce survey in 2007 found Minnesota courts ranking in the top 10 in terms of competence and fairness. We also did a recent survey of Minnesota residents, which you have in your packets and slides from that particular survey, which provides you with more detail, but the survey results are very positive for Minnesota judges, showing that in areas of trustworthiness, fairness, impartiality, competence, they rank very high in the 80% or higher level, which as you'll see from the slides in your packet, is much higher than many states around the country. So we use those measures of outside entities to also look at our performance and measure our performance. The branch does not just rely, however, on these outside entities. The Judicial Council has established its own policies for looking at our performance. We're consistently evaluating our performance to maintain high levels of quality, service, and accountability for our use of resources. I'm going to ask Deb Daly to come forward and talk a little bit about those Judicial Council policies and the measures that we use.
Please come forward, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you. I'm Deb Daly. I am the manager of the Research and Evaluation Unit in State Court Administration, and I would like to thank you for this opportunity to come today and talk to you about the Judicial Branch's initiative on court performance measures. I think it's very exciting what we're doing. We're just taking our first steps, and so you're going to get sort of a preview of what we're all just starting to see for the first time. But I think you will find it to be hopefully very interesting and something that will be ongoing for you to touch base with us on. On this first slide, what we're showing you is that we now have a judicial council policy as it relates to performance. And it really is one of the first policy areas that was addressed by the judicial council back in 2005. The council felt it was very important to establish what matters most to the branch and to the citizens of Minnesota and determine how we can measure those things and to look at this from a system-wide perspective. And so one of the things that they did was to look at what was happening around the country, and we're fortunate that we have a National Center for State Court that has also been kind of looking into this whole area, and they had come up with something called the core tools, which are 10 key measures that kind of relate to the business of the court that they are in the process of trying to promote across the country to get folks engaged in using these key measures to help determine how the courts are doing across the country. We are utilizing several of those core tools, but just so you know, we are connecting with what's going on nationally, and so this is going to enable us to also compare ourselves to other places around the country. So if we look at the next slide then, what I'd like to also make mention of is that it's important to recognize that Minnesota really is one of the cutting-edge folks in regard to the performance measures for courts, in the sense that there's only been a handful of other states that have really engaged in implementing sort of comprehensive performance measures for the courts across the entire state. Examples would be Utah, Oregon, Massachusetts, also Kansas and New Jersey have some timeliness-type measures. And there are some individual jurisdictions in various places across the country that have done these comprehensive performance measures, including Lubbock County, Texas, of all places. So this is happening, but I just wanted to let you know that it is, you know, like I say, on the forefront of kind of what the courts are doing. So in order to implement this effort, we first of all had to complete the implementation of statewide case management system, MINSIS. And that is because much of the data that we get for the performance measures comes from that case management system. And then we proceeded to do some other things. Our judicial council did not want our performance measures to just be about timeliness. While it's very important, we also wanted to get a perspective of what the public thinks of our court and what our employees think of working for our court. So we also conducted two separate types of surveys. One was court participant surveys. We actually conducted these in every single county across the entire state during the time frame from January of 2008 through June of 2008. And we conducted workplace surveys for all our court employees and judges, and that was just done in September of 2008. And we also do have very numerous timeliness reports that we've developed, and we've put those into a pulling that information out of a data warehouse, which allows us to give these types of reports to court staff and judges on demand. So judges and court staff can literally go onto our intranet site and pull up these reports as needed to take a look at how they're doing with respect to timeliness. We also have implemented a data quality program I want to mention, because that's very important when you're going to embark upon doing anything with information. You should be try to be sure that information is accurate, also because this information in our case management system is the electronic court record. It needs to be accurate, and so part of this whole initiative has been about doing data quality and finding ways for us to investigate where there are problems and to fix them when we find them and to continue to improve on the quality of our data. So that's also been part of it. Yay. Results are now available. I didn't know that I was going to do that. Okay. I mentioned we have two areas of work that we've done, survey work and then the timeliness report. We're just going to show you a few examples of the results today. I want you to know that there is a full report. It's very dense. You can go look at it. At the end of the presentation, there is a website that you can access this full report. It is our first full report that we have provided to the Judicial Council. It just was presented to them in mostly in November, somewhat, and also in December, so it is very new, but there's much, much more there if you want to go to that. Also, to let you know that this information that we have now is more or less a baseline. It's our beginning. It's we're going to, from henceforth, track trends and progress, and so there is still much to examine. And I'm sort of saying that somewhat to kind of prepare you that you may ask me questions that I don't know the answer to. And that's because there is so much here and there's so much for us to look at. And we do need to figure out what is behind some of these results. We don't know yet everything, but it is at least there for us to start asking questions and digging into the information. So, is it this one? So let's move forward to look at the actual data results then. I mentioned that we did these participant surveys in every single court across the state. We actually received 7,700 survey responses in over 100 locations across the state. We had a total response rate of 79%. That's absolutely extraordinary for the type of survey that this was, where you actually get people when they come out of the courtroom, you ask them, invite them to take the survey before they leave. It's really quite extraordinary to get that kind of response rate. This chart here is just showing you our mean scores. On a scale from 1 to 5, what was the mean score? And it's showing you, this is related to our access to justice goal. And you can see the ones that stand on top versus the ones that are maybe a little bit lower. We did the best, for instance, on folks being able to find the courthouse, being treated with courtesy and respect, and being able to find the courtroom where they needed to go. Perhaps we did less well on things such as hours were easy for me. We certainly can't. We don't do off hours. In fact, unfortunately, we've had to cut back on hours, and this may exemplify some of that. That happening out there. Also, get business done in a reasonable time wasn't as well. You're going to see in some of our timeliness measures, this may be actually showing up with folks feeling that they're not getting their business done, or it could even relate to them waiting for court to start. I mean, that's certainly something that's possible too. As I say, we need to investigate these things. And then our court website being useful, that was our lowest score, and we do need to look at that. In fact, we're planning to do now an on-site survey of our web, our public website to get better input into what isn't perhaps interesting. We also had on that same survey, we took a look at the fairness and equity questions, and we created what we call an index score. There's several questions that relate to fairness and equity. And an index score is simply a composite of all those questions where we can then create a scale of 0 to 100. And we did very, very well, actually, on the fairness index score. We scored 83. In fact, almost all statements had at least 80% agreement in terms of people feeling that they were treated fairly. So that is one where we have done fairly well. In the area of excellence, again, this was done via the survey. We also did very well here. This particular goal is measured by the question of whether participants know what to do next about their case, and we found that actually this had the highest mean score of any of the questions on our fairness, and over 85% of respondents agreed or strongly agreed with this statement.
Forgive me if you've already answered this question, but how many surveys did you send out, and how many did you get back? You know,
Madam Chair, this was not a process where we sent out surveys. We actually conducted these survey processes in the courthouses themselves. So we set up tables. We had folks who manned the table, so to speak. And as people came out of the courtrooms, they were asked to fill out these survey forms. The judges in the courtrooms let folks know that we were conducting these surveys and ask for them to stop by and to fill out the form. So it was pretty much an interactive process within the courthouse that, you know, was not something that we sent out to folks. And I think that is probably one of the reasons why we did get such a high response rate, because it was more of an interactive process. And we also, I think most of the courts that did this had candy on the table and things of that sort too. It was actually done, we learned this from other places around the country, that to make it inviting, you know, there were posters and signs and encouragement to participate. We gave out stickers. The little emblem that you see on the slide there, you be the judge. I mean, that was sort of the theme. It was people's opportunity and chance to actually be able to tell us what their experience was all about.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, so now we're going to move. I think we're going to move on to timeliness. We have three key measures that we look at to try to help us understand how we're doing with respect to timeliness. No one of these measures alone tells us the whole story. And so we've got clearance rates, time of disposition, and age of pending. Clearance rates are simply the issue of do we dispose cases, as many cases as we get filed in a given year, because if we don't, they're going to start to pile up. Time of disposition, are we disposing cases within our timing objectives? The Judicial Council has set timing objectives for how quickly cases should get done. And thirdly, age of pending. Are our pending cases older than our timing objectives? Pending cases are the ones we're not done with yet. And are they growing older and older and older and starting to backlog? Clearance rates, for the most part, if we look at them overall, which isn't maybe the most revealing way to do that, in 2007, for which this report is based on, our overall clearance rate was 99%. So 100% is absolutely what you need in order to avoid any sort of backlog. 99% is very good. But there are certainly case-type areas where we are seeing some problems. The civil clearance rates, for instance, are an issue. And over the course of time from 2003 through 2007, the clearance rates, because they have been dropping, have created a growing pending caseload of 36%. So that is something that we do need to take a closer look at. Our dependency neglect cases are also suffering from a clearance rate that is relatively low, that we need to kind of pay attention to this. So those are just two areas that we have to take a look at. With respect to the criminal area, let's take a look at the time of disposition measure, because that one, as I mentioned, is a way to look at the cases that have already been disposed and how long do they take to dispose. And we are breaking this chart down into our major, some of our major case type areas. And you see what those case type areas are on the first column. The second column tells you what we call our 99th percentile. We're saying that cases should be disposed, 99% of the cases should be disposed within the given month that's listed here. So, for instance, major criminal, 99% of all of our cases should get disposed within 12 months. And the question is, are we doing that? If you look over at the percentile that follows that, you see that actually 9.7% of them do not. They actually are taking longer than that 99th percentile objective. Some of the other case types are doing far better. The juvenile delinquency you see is at 7.7. So that one also is one that we need to be paying attention to, because we are not doing those cases as quickly as what our timing objective would suggest. And then the next chart, I just want to give you a little bit more detail. If we were to look at some of the breakouts of our major criminal cases, this is essentially the same kind of information, and not to get too involved here, but we do have some other percentiles as well. This chart shows you we have a 90th percentile, 97th percentile, and a 99th percentile. So we also are trying to get certain percentages of cases done within a four-month time frame or a six-month time frame as well. But I would like you to simply to focus on the 12 months, because that's the one that stands out the most. And when we go beyond 12 months, that's when we really start to create a backlog. And from this chart, you can see that our serious felonies, which are essentially our homicides and our sex offenses, are 29% of them are over our 99th percentile. So it's clearly an area where we've got to put some focus. And even in the other two felony areas, we have felony DWI and all other felonies. Even there, we have a fairly significant percentage of our cases falling beyond the 99th percentile. And then lastly, with respect to timeliness, I wanted to show you age of pending cases. Again, I'm speaking to this 99th percentile. We can use that same timing objective to look at the cases that haven't been disposed that are in the process of getting done. And this is just showing you each judicial district and where they stand with respect to all their cases on this particular percentile. And you can see some districts are doing better than others. Some, actually, the fourth, for instance, has only 3% of their cases that fall beyond the 99th percentile. But the first, fifth, and tenth have 14% of their cases falling beyond the 99th percentile.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the testifier, I have actually have two questions. First one, I apologize if you've addressed this, but as far as how you're measuring what percentile they fall in, do you have it broken down into reasons why? I mean, some cases they're charged and or faster than maybe some other ones that need some more investigation, or maybe there is a vacancy in the in the judicial branch that causes for backup, or maybe there's a district court kind of changes how they organize themselves that kind of skew the numbers a little bit. Are you measuring the reasons why for the delay in each of these categories?
Oh, Madam Chair and Representative Bingham, I think that those are excellent questions, and what I think needs to happen is for the individual districts to start looking at their data and start to dig in to ask those questions about what's happening. Clearly, it is the case that when I showed you that chart on the serious felonies versus other felonies, serious felonies are probably more likely to go to trial. They probably are going to take more time. I would expect those backup cases to have more cases beyond the 99th percentile. The question is that too many, what we do have? And it would seem to be so. So we need to dig in and look at that, and we need to start, you know, working through this data at the district level, even within judicial counsel, and start thinking about what is happening.
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad you said that you think it's that the district court should be looking at these reasons, which leads me to my next question. What kind of audit mechanisms do you have in the department, whether it's on the district court level or as a state as a whole? Internal auditors, maybe how many internal auditors do you have in your department?
Ms. Daly.
Mr. Dorba?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, we have right now two internal auditors that do an internal audit, mostly on financial issues, but we also use audit teams from our court services division to go out and look at business practices and other types of practices within the courts. And most recently, they've done a lot of audits of how we're implementing MNSIS and our business practices there. In addition, as I mentioned, for financial reasons, the Office of Legislative Auditor usually on an annual basis comes in to do an audit.
Okay. Representative Bingham, just a comment. I like MNSIS.
I also wanted to ask a question about these numbers.
So would you be able to break these out in the future then based on, you know, serious felonies, for example, then by judicial district as well? Because, for example, a place like Hennepin County or Ramsey County may have more of some of these more serious crimes, and therefore they may take longer, or would you have the ability to break that information out further, Ms. Daly?
Madam Chair, absolutely. In fact, that's something that we have, you know, talked with the Judicial Council about, that this is just the beginning, and we want districts to ask further questions and ask for further breakdowns of data. The report that I mentioned that is available on our public website does have some further breakdowns in it as well. It does have information in the appendix that's very detailed, but all of this can be broken down in various ways by case type, by county, by district. You know, what we don't know is the actual cases themselves, you know, what the circumstances completely are with respect to what might be happening. This particular chart is done in such a way that we wanted to point out, we don't know if this is a coincidence or what, but the districts that do show that they have the highest percentage of cases that are pending beyond the 99th percentile also happen to be the districts that are in the greatest need of judges. And so certainly not having enough judges and not being able to get things scheduled as quickly and to have things flow as smoothly can also contribute to that. So that's just, you know, one thing. But there could be many things that do go on that folks need to dig in and try to figure out what's happening.
And can you also tell me if these numbers include the appeals or if it's just the trial court level?
Madam Chair, this is just the trial court data.
Okay.
We do have performance measures for the Court of Appeals and for the Supreme Court. I didn't include them here, but they are in the report, and we did want to be inclusive. We wanted everyone to have something to take a look at in terms of their performance.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. The next chart then, just moving away from the timing measures, there's one more fairness measure I wanted to point out, and that was we had a question of our jurors and whether they're representative of our community. So we took a look at and compared jurors who report to court as to whether they're similar, for instance, racially to the population statewide. And what we did find out is that there is a very close relationship between the proportion of these various racial groups in the community based on the census data and the information that we have by race for our jurors. So this was an area where we were pleased to see these results. And then lastly, with respect to what I'm going to show you today on results, I just wanted to mention that another one of our goals is a quality court workplace environment, and we did do a survey of both our employees and our judges. We did them separately because there were somewhat different questions on each one of them. And this is just showing you, again, some of our index scores for our employees and our judges. And index scores were created because there were almost 40 questions on this survey, and it's so hard to kind of look at all the questions. And so we put the questions into various groupings, which is what you see across the bottom, groupings based on supervision, work conditions, achievement, so forth. And the closer you get to 100, 100 would be perfect. Of course, that would probably not be the case. But certainly these scores are fairly good. I think we were pleased to see them. We are going to be reviewing these results at the district and the state court administration level. We actually have plans to focus in on several particular areas. We believe strongly that this is something that we have to pay attention to. In these tight budget times, it's important to keep good morale amongst our employees and our judges. I would mention that the one question that scored the highest, and this sort of sat with me fairly strongly, was 88% and 97% of our branch employees and judges respectively expressed high levels of agreement with the statements that they are proud to work for the court and understand how they contribute to the overall mission of the judicial branch. I think that that's very astounding, that particular one was as high as it was, and it really is a very positive outcome for us in moving forward. If we know we have folks who really believe in what they're doing, they are very proud to be working for the judicial branch, I think that that's going to help us in these very tight budget times.
I have a question actually back on the previous slide about the jurors. Did you also look at, and would it be in the presentation, maybe the socioeconomic status of the jurors as well, not just the the racial makeup of the population?
Madam Chair, we did not have that kind of data available. We did look at the gender, so we did do some also comparisons of the gender, which is in the report, and we were fairly close there as well, although I believe there isn't slightly more women represented in jurors than there are in the population. It was a little bit higher in the women. But that we did not have the socioeconomic information available to us. But we could look and see what that would take to do that. I'm just not really sure if that's in our jury data. It may be in the census data, but I'm not sure that we have that captured in our jury database.
All right. Questions from members? Representative Gerkowski. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Daly and Mr. Shorba, thank you for your presentation today. One question I would have would lead back to Chair Hillstrom's question about the methodologies for doing the surveys. From the background, at least my experience in surveys, I would encourage you to take a look at that methodology. When you have the survey right there and have the candy dish, and I wonder about whether there's the ability to be anonymous in responding, and I wonder about who sticks around to fill the survey out versus those who leave. In order to get a more accurate take of that, I encourage you to maybe think about the methodology. I had a question maybe for Ms. if you've got a comment. Sure.
Ms. Daly.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right that does sort of, that there could be some concerns about that. Certainly people didn't have to take the survey. We did assure them that it was anonymous. In fact, our policy for reporting results is that we do not report any results that are less than 10. So for instance, that anyone might be able to discern from the survey who might have answered a particular question by knowing who was in court that day and how they might have answered the combination of various answers. We will not report information as such. We offer people opportunities to also give us comments. And so we do have comments. And that kind of tells us that not everyone's happy. We do know that we did get some folks that had some actually constructive criticisms that we certainly should take heed of. But I appreciate your saying that because I think it is a point well taken. I think you're sort of in this business, you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place as far as how you actually get the public to respond. We do have the other public survey that that Jeff mentioned that we did, where it's more of a phone survey, not necessarily people who came to court that day, but people just in general. And so we do have that as well. But
you know, some of your points are well taken.
Thank you.
Representative,
question for Mr. Sherba. The you mentioned the restructuring some of the areas of the guardian ad litems and interpreters and so forth. My question is about interpreters. Interpreters are one of the areas in the court system that have provided the greatest increase in cost, along with psych services, as I understand.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any ways, have the courts looked at ways to recoup some of the cost to interpreters? I understand there's there are at least anecdotal situations where, you know, fraudulent use of interpreters have occurred, if you will. People get through their court experience and suddenly they speak English. And it's actually used, at least from what I've heard from people, as a way to delay the game and another leverage or something in the process. Have you looked at ways to recoup some of those costs from the users?
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, obviously we're on the lookout for fraud at all times, and we try to use contract interpreters that we have a trusting relationship with. Unfortunately, we are under a constitutional obligation. When somebody asks for an interpreter, there's no test that we can give them or way on site that we can see whether or not they actually can speak English sufficiently to appear in court. So because of that constitutional obligation, and obviously we've also are under the microscope, we've had some lawsuits by situations where maybe we have not provided an interpreter quickly enough and had to work with the courts on those lawsuits. So we're very careful about how we provide interpreters. But we try to use ones who we think we have a trusting relationship with. We have contracts that we put out so that the individuals who are working on it would possibly be able to catch that kind of thing, but it's very difficult when we've got that constitutional obligation. And we have not, as far as I know, gone back in a situation, at least to my knowledge, where something has come up and we've been given evidence. I don't know of any situation like that where we've had to go back and recoup types of costs. I'm not aware of that.
Mr. Drazkowski, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is, I mean, has a court looked at a ways to recoup those costs, maybe a fee-for-service type of thing like some of the other services that are out there for the users of those services to bring back, if you will, the essence of personal responsibility that comes with some of that? And maybe you don't need to answer that now, but that's really what I was looking at. The other question is, have you looked at the demographic among those people who are here legally who use their services and those who may be illegal aliens?
Mr. Sherba, now, if it gets into finance, we have to be careful because we need to make sure we take care of some of the finance stuff in the finance committee. I don't want to, you know, trounce on Representative Paymar's jurisdiction here, but Mr. Sherba, if you would like
Madam Chair, Representative, we do not look at any status of legal or illegal as far as interpreter requests. As far as your other question, I think what you're asking about is something similar maybe to public defenders where there's some kind of an income test. I'm not aware of any type of situation like that, and I can certainly see if there has been before our budget hearings in a couple weeks.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you. Question for Mr. Sherba. I practice law in the 7th Judicial District, which has to be one of the most efficient there is, and I'm wondering, and I know that the 7th and the 8th also combined their administration. Is there some movement for other judicial districts to also combine? That's question one, so you can answer that first.
Yes.
Mr. Sherba.
Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, we are looking at that. The Judicial Council has now set forth a policy that if any of the district administrative positions are vacated and there are some individuals who may be nearing retirement, we would not fill those until there's been a review of looking at combination. The 7th and the 8th has been a strong success story. Not only have we combined the district administrative positions, but we've also been able to combine human resources and finance and other lower-level subordinate positions to share across those districts. We're trying to do those even if we're not changing some of the district administrative things. We're trying to do more work across district lines in terms of sharing. Some of the interpreter issues are now done across district lines so that we can share those interpreter resources. We're now looking at, in the interpreter areas, one example, having perhaps telephone interpreting where we may have an individual who's located at a courthouse who can do telephone interpreting for other courthouses outside or within their own district. So, as again, state funding has allowed us to have a lot of flexibility on that, and the 7th and 8th is certainly one success story.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you. My other question is, one of the efficiencies that I've noticed in my own district courthouse is that for certain things like uncontested probates, no court appearance is required, and that obviously saves on the time for the judge and the staff and the lawyers, and the clients save money. And yet there are other areas that don't do that, that require court appearances even for, say, a non-contested probate. And I'm wondering, and I won't name names of counties, but I could tell you afterwards, and I'm wondering if there's going to be some movement toward the level of efficiency that, that I have in the Seventh, where matters like that won't take up, unnecessarily take up court time.
Mr. Shorba?
Madam Chair, Representative. We are looking at both types of areas. For example, we recently expanded what we call our payables list, which are the number of offenses that are within court jurisdiction of the Judicial Council to deem payable, so they do not require an appearance. So we greatly expanded that given our low staffing level that we have right now, judges as well as court staff. So we are constantly trying to review that to make as many appearances unnecessary as possible and allow individuals to pay it. I will tell you that there's pushback from jurisdictions on that, city attorneys, county attorneys, others who may feel that an appearance would be positive in some way in these cases, but the court and the Judicial Council has felt that it's necessary at this point given staffing. So we are looking at exactly the type of thing that you're pointing to. What can we do to reduce our workload given the lack of budget that we have right now in terms of the court? So a very good point.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's what Representative Jackson raised concerns me. And I don't know what is happening there, but an uncontested probate normally goes through, but I have actually seen where people have not admitted to their attorney, a relative or something, who would have taken a share. And that came out in court because kind of the presence of the court, and I don't know if it's probably not the swearing in, whatever it did, scared them enough or something. So I'm just wondering where that's actually going.
Actually, Representative Mullery, that is within the jurisdiction of your committee, so I would assume that when the court comes to your committee, you'd be happy to take that up. So with that, is there any other questions from members with the jurisdiction of this committee? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation. This meeting is adjourned.